behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bolin.
Ben, we're back with part two of our Monte Carlo podcast.
Yes. Yes, the time has come. Again.
Not a real cliffhanger or anything like that, but I believe when we left off, we were talking about pricing, right?
Yeah, we were talking about the pricing of the first-gen Monte Carlo compared to the base price and then the options added on, the ones that everybody added on, and how this compares to the other cars in the market at the time.
Yeah, and then we even brought in the 2010 Chevrolet Camaro, which is the replacement for it in 2010.
Yep.
So that and how that translated into it. But you got to remember that, you know, this is a personal luxury coupe back in 1970. It was the cheapest car in the segment at the time, and that's why it just sold like crazy. I mean, people loved the Monte Carlo.
Loved it so much that it was even difficult to get a dealer discount.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sold extremely well in 1970, 1971. There was even like this long UAW strike that happened in the fall of 1970, and you know, production was cut down, and they still were selling cars like crazy. I mean, it didn't, you know, have any kind of impact on that at all. And, well, I'm sure it had some, but it didn't have any impact on sales really overall. But one thing, you know, we need to just take a moment here, and I want to mention something because I think people are going to get the wrong impression.
Are we going to do some myth busting?
Just a little bit.
And yeah.
The Monte Carlo was not a muscle car.
Nope. And Chevy didn't say it was.
Yeah, that's the thing. They never, ever marketed Monte Carlo as a muscle car, which I can understand because we've talked about the strict rules that people adhere to for, you know, muscle car production, I guess, and, you know, what people consider a muscle car. And some people are very, very, the purists, I guess, are very, very, very strict about what they call a muscle car.
Down to years of certain models.
What's a pony car and what's a sports car and what's not even considered in this whole thing. And they get very, very... I don't know what to say, irate about it, but they get upset. They get upset about it, you know, when you try to call a car that is not a muscle car one. Well, Chevrolet never proposed to do that. They never said that, you know, this is the latest muscle car out of Detroit or anything, but, you know, they had the Chevelle, they had the Malibu SS, and that was for that type of buyer. So they had other vehicles that fit that bill.
Right, and you could say that the SS 454 was more in that direction, in that muscle car direction, but Scott, they didn't sell very many of those at all.
No, I guess. And they had the GTO, which was, you know, that one sold quite a bit, but it wasn't, it was just a different car, Ben. I mean, it was a different buyer, different car, and they never said the Monte Carlo was anything like that, but, you know, they did have this fantastic SS454 package, which we just hinted at last time.
Right.
And it was a big deal, really. I mean, it was a really strong engine.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to make sure that I get this right, exactly what it was. It was a 427 engine, I believe, that was stroked to 454.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they upped it quite a bit in cubic inches.
Yeah, I've got the horsepower, it was rated at 360 horsepower, Scott, and that's at 4,800 RPM. It's got heavy suspension, heavy-duty suspension. It's got wider tires. Of course, it's got some badging so that people know. It's got the rear leveling suspension. This is a more performance-pointed car. How about that?
Obviously, yeah. But, you know, the thing is that it didn't sell a lot of them. Now, it had a, an RPO code for this one, and I'll have to dig that one up as well. You know, what that RPO code was. Maybe I'll find it, maybe I won't, but, it was a special order vehicle, really.
Right.
And it was subtle. It was very, very subtle in the way that they disguised this thing. Now, the badging that you mentioned, it wasn't anything outrageous. It wasn't anything
right.
Like you're not going to be able to tell this is an SS from far away. You're going to have to be up close. You're going to have to really know your vehicle makes and models to be able to pick it out. And they sold very, very few of them. In fact, from 1970 to 1971, which is the only time they offered the SS454 package in the original Gen 1 vehicles, they sold less than 6,000 total.
Right. And that means that if you are lucky enough to have one now, you should hang on to it and take care of it.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing was, it was a heavy car. You know, it just wasn't, even though it was this performance package and people thought, you know, that was really great. People also realize that I could get much more vehicle if I order the Chevelle, or if I order maybe that Malibu SS, or if I go for the Pontiac GTO.
Right.
If I go for, you know, a different type of vehicle that is more performance oriented than this one that's kind of, they put a bigger engine in a personal luxury car, really.
Yeah, and that's a really good way to say it, because let's also point out, just to dig a little deeper in that, that of that span from 1970-1971, we said fewer than 6,000, mm-hmm. the majority of those sales were in 1970. So it seems like the market decided, hey, if I'm going to get something with more performance, why am I piddling around?
Yeah, because I think there were less than 2,000 of them sold in 1971. It was like just under that. It was like 1,900 or something.
Yes.
So now what Monte Carlo did have going for it was that it looked and felt a lot more expensive than it was. Now,
right.
It was like this aspirational car, I guess, because the owners probably wanted a Thunderbird, because Ford Thunderbird was kind of the king of the roost there at that point.
Yep.
Just coin a term, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But if you couldn't afford, the Thunderbird, you couldn't afford even a Grand Prix that you maybe wanted, well, then maybe Monte Carlo was your car.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good point too. So we're in 1971. So in 1971, there are some changes, but there aren't very many. It's very small. And then 1972, kind of the same thing. But 1973, Scott, we see the second generation of the Monte Carlo, right?
Yeah, and this is a collaborative design effort. It's something that a lot of different designers had their hands in the cookie jar here on this one, because it wasn't just one designer like the first gen was, with Terry Henlein.
Right.
This is a lot of people coming together and saying, "What can we do to make this car even better?" And what they did was they made even a longer hood. They stretched out the hood even longer. So they exaggerated some of the fender flares. It seems like they made a cartoon version of this car, really. And I say that, in a loving way, Ben. A caricature. And I don't mean it's a bad thing. I think the second generation cars are really pretty cool looking.
Mm-hmm.
They made this long hood, these exaggerated fender flares, even more so than before. They had these, they called it Jaguar-like headlight blisters that extended into the hood, and you can kind of understand what I mean by that. I mean the shape of the headlight trails off into the hood.
Mm-hmm.
They had these opera windows at the back on the sail panels that people either loved or hated those things. They were a fixed window, and it really didn't do anything for sight lines or anything like that. But the second gen cars, Ben, these are the ones that I have a lot of experience with. These, I had two cousins that were older than me in Indiana,
mm-hmm.
and older than me, like the kind that exactly the age where I would look up to. They were the cooler older kids, right? They're like 6 years older than
me. Five, six, that's the sweet
spot.
Exactly.
Brother, sister, and they owned a couple of used Monte Carlos from the second generation at the same time. So when they're in high school, their parents, my aunt and uncle, bought the boy a black one, all black. Really, really slick looking.
Yeah,
the second
gen
one. And, the girl had a copper colored one with, I think it had a white top. I'm not sure. Maybe a white or black top.
Okay.
Vinyl top.
Yeah.
And, these cars were awesome. They were so cool. They're big V8s, long, long front end. Of course, high school kids. So they had, at the time, you got to remember, cassette tapes were pretty new.
Yeah.
A cassette player with the equalizer, the booster and all that.
You could change the bass.
Exactly.
And the treble.
Play that Billy Squire as loud as you want it to. But, that was the era that I'm talking about, like the late 70s, but they had the early 70s versions of these, and I thought those Monte Carlos were the coolest car around.
Yeah, and I like your point about all the people who did weigh in on these. Irv Rubicki is one of the new players in the game at this time, but we've got some returners here. Bill Mitchell is still kind of the guy giving the green lights on these.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's Ed Cole. We've got Bill Porter, Charles Stewart, and it's funny because when they look back in this in retrospect, when you have this whole stew of designers, or maybe a better comparison is when you have this many cooks in the kitchen,
mm-hmm.
The origin of certain ideas gets kind of fuzzy.
Yeah.
So you'll be talking to these people and they'll say, well, I think those opera windows came from maybe that was Irv.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, and there's not even the great computer file system that we've got now that you could just trace back to see who submitted the idea originally, right?
So right.
You could say I'm not exactly sure who came up with that, but boy, that was a bad idea. Let's move on, even though it was your own idea.
Right, exactly. And we toured, that's a little close to home sometimes. So we're at this point, John DeLorean and some of his entourage, we'll say, are watching this this black and silver model that's in the styling studios, and DeLorean's guest go nuts and bananas. They love the second gen. And so John DeLorean says, do it. Go. Green light. Don't change a thing.
Mm-hmm. And it sold really well again.
Yeah.
So the Monte Carlo is, again, proving itself a popular choice in the marketplace. It's priced right. People really like these coupes. You know, it's got these exaggerated lines. Like we said, that long, long front end, extremely short back deck. And this is going to be a styling trait throughout the entire Monte Carlo history.
Right.
I mean, from beginning to end, you're going to find that long front end. You're going to find that solid roof line. You're going to find the two doors. You're going to find that very, very short rear deck lid.
Yeah.
And those are styling cues that are going to follow it all the way through. And second gen was no exception. And people loved it. They sold extremely well again. They sold all the way through, about 1978, I think, Ben.
Yeah.
When they decided that, you know, it's time to make another change. And this change was, well, it's a pretty dramatic one. They downsized significantly the size of, the overall size of the vehicle in 1978.
Mm-hmm.
As they did with all other General Motors products at the time, because, you know, there was another fuel shortage crisis going on. It was like, trying to cut back on some of these giant, land yacht type vehicles
that
they have, because they had a bunch of them still. Even in the late 70s, they were still building really, really big cars.
In the midst of gas crisis.
I mean, take a look at a photo of a second gen, Monte Carlo, and just look how big that thing is and how heavy those are and the size engines that those would require. And then look at what they came out with in 1978 for the third gen.
Right before we jump into that, just mm-hmm. for context, we need to point out the Thunderbird, which we mentioned in part one, our earlier podcast. Thunderbird sales were doing very well, but they were shy of the Monte Carlo. They still weren't selling as much as the Monte Carlo.
No kidding. I wouldn't have guessed that. I would have thought they
eclipsed them.
I thought they still would have been on top. But okay, so Monte Carlo has now surpassed Thunderbird in sales. So, you know, they're doing exactly what they want. Remember this back and forth with Ford that we were talking about?
Yes.
So it's like a reaction. It's an action reaction, really, between Ford and Chevrolet with what they do. And it's all marketing ploys. It's all mm-hmm. design cues and characteristics. And they're trying to one up each other on these designs.
And, so we've set up our third generation here, 13 inches shorter, right?
Yeah, it's quite a bit shorter. I mean, you're talking about, you know, shortening a car more than a foot, and it lost 700 pounds in this transaction. So, it's losing a lot of weight in the, mm-hmm. In the interim between second gen and third gen.
Oh, about 318 kilograms for our friends outside of the U.S.
Very good, Ben. Very good. Thank you. And, it sold really well again at first. Now, it's a much smaller design. Of course, they're still being powered with these big V8 engines.
Yes.
People are still loving that. You know, that it's still got all the power of the American car, American coupe that they wanted. But it's definitely a much smaller package, and it's a more efficient package.
Right.
Big V8.
Yeah, still got a big V8, and you would think that because it's lighter and there's just less body for the engine to move, mm-hmm. that people would love it, but sales dropped in 1980. Dropped isn't even a fair word. They plummeted.
Yeah, they started to, well, they didn't, I'm not going to say slowly creep off, but they did. They just dropped right off. It was it was kind of the end of an era, I guess. And again, they said, well, man, this is not long after this, Ben. They decided that they needed to do another facelift on this thing. So in the mid-80s, they came out with an SS model, which they hadn't had again since 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And, they also came out with like a semi fastback aero coupe, you know, for NASCAR, homologation purposes, you know, so they had to build a certain number of these fastback,
right.
Aero coupes.
And that's homologation is where you have to have a car that is technically in production for it to participate on the track.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why you'll see these production cars that have production runs of, you know, like 12.
Yeah, something low like that. And oftentimes it'll be like 200 or something.
Yeah, I know.
Like
I'm exaggerating. But
in cases, Ben, there's some cases where maybe they will have like 12 or something like that, where they just need to compete in one series and it's a small series. In some of these bigger international series, they require several hundred,
mm-hmm.
where they hold a few back for the actual race cars.
But it doesn't work. The strategy doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work because, you know, this mid-80s facelift that we're talking about, even with the addition of the SS model and the fastback and all that, the sales just continue to fade until, they decided that, you know, in 1988, we're just going to have to give this up for a while.
Right, and there is no production of Monte Carlos between about the, I'd say the end of 87.
Yeah, and you know what? I do want to mention something before anybody gets, you know, upset with us. We're going to go back and talk about NASCAR after all this. So, NASCAR is huge throughout this whole time. We'll get to it, I promise. But, you know, from 1988 to 1995, no Monte Carlo production at all. And then in 1995, Chevy kind of resurrected this old, the old Monte Carlo name for a front-wheel drive coupe, which was, you know, kind of a new idea for them.
Yeah, all right. So if I could take a second on this one.
Of course.
Thank you. The first four generations, rear-wheel drive, closely related to the Grand Prix. It's this
big V8, powerful.
Big V8, yeah. Thank you for pointing that out, too. Fifth generation comes back, and I can say this because I owned one. This thing is totally different car.
Yeah.
It's got a front drive. It's on alumina body. People, alumina body. I'm sorry. and it's not the same inch. Like the V8 is optional later on.
Yeah, it's a two-door Lumina is what it is, really.
And, yeah, that's fair.
I mean, that's what it is. It's a two-door Chevy Lumina. And it, again, Ben, I don't know how it happened. Maybe it's just nostalgia here, but it sold actually pretty well. I mean, not great. Sales were around 70,000 a year, which sounds really good, right? I mean, to sell 70,000 cars a year.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just became a kind of like this niche-type car. I mean, people didn't necessarily grab onto it and say that, you know, it's our favorite car ever and we're promoting this. And, you know, they weren't attracting many new buyers, I guess. Now, they were getting people for nostalgia purposes, I believe, you know, saying, I'd like to get that new Monte Carlo and see how it compares to the old Monte Carlo that I used to drive.
And I had never had an old Monte Carlo, you know, I don't want to say I've missed the boat forever because I would like to go back and get one of the older ones and you know, mod it up and do some cool stuff with it. I have so many ideas, but the one I had from the fifth gen, 1997, it was a good car and the price was right for me too. I've never been that guy who will get a supercar, or at least I haven't been him yet. But here's hope, and I will tell you though, I prefer the 97 that I had to the one I have now.
No kidding.
Maybe it's nostalgia. That's what I was going to ask you. Do you think it's nostalgia?
90. Well, I don't know. 97 to 2000. I'm sorry. What did you say? What year?
The 97. 97 was the one that I had originally, and now I have like a 04.
Okay, so well, I could say it's nostalgia on something like that. I mean, it's pretty much the same design, right?
You know what? To me, probably because I'm driving it, there are some differences. Like the design, the exterior. I gotta say, I prefer the fourth generation exterior, and it's not. You know how it's like when your car is kind of like your kid or your pet or something. You know, you notice small stuff about it way more than anybody else.
Of course.
So to me, they're very, very different animals. And I've asked myself, because I sat down before we did this and I was writing out some ideas about trying to figure out which one would be my favorite of the bunch. And the fifth generation, man, it's still better. And I think one of the reasons why is because I don't have to drive it every day and deal with some of the problems, because the one I drive now, GM has had some problems with these things. So let's take stock here real quick for this show. We've got NASCAR yet to talk about, which we're both very excited about. But then we also have something that I think we should get to first. And Scott, you know, I ask you for a lot of advice.
Yeah, sometimes.
I mean, you're good at advice.
Thank you. I'm an idea guy.
You're a big picture guy.
Yeah, that's right.
It would be, we're very lucky that you don't give bad advice.
Just don't ask me to implement anything. Just, I can come up with the ideas.
Yeah, you're a theory man. Right now, which is the worst segue I've ever done, let's get back to the Monte Carlo.
Yeah, and you know what? We've talked about just the, kind of the way it just kind of trailed off, I guess. You know, and the way that, you know, we talked about the 95, Monte Carlo redesign and how it just, it sold really well to begin with. Not great, you know, 70,000 a year or something like that.
Right.
But then it just kind of became this niche product that eventually just trailed off into nothing. It just slowly went away, really.
Well, I think for a lot, I think it's important to note, again, that point about nostalgia. It's not an extraordinary car.
Well, Well, you know, the thing is that it wasn't just Monte Carlo that went away during that time. You got to remember that in the 90s, I guess the mid-90s, the late 90s, a lot of the big coupes kind of went away, you know, like in the cars that were the big coupe, even Thunderbird, the Ford Thunderbird went away during that same time. So its main competition has gone away. And when I say that it became a niche car, a lot of times what you'd see on the road, Ben, and you can back me up on this probably.
Sure.
A lot of the cars that you would see on the road that were new Monte Carlos were these pace cars.
Oh, yeah.
And they had this whole line of pace cars that they came out with along the way. And before we mention NASCAR, which was, you know, really, really prevalent in Monte Carlo history, there was this whole series of production vehicles that Chevrolet came out with that were these pace cars, and they were all designed very similar. Now, they all had different colors, and they all had different different concept behind them, I suppose.
And they were all pretty limited in production.
Very limited. I mean, some of them, you know, like I think the most produced one was like, you know, just over 2,000, because they did it between 2000 and 2003. So there were 4 years where they produced these pace cars with different colors to signify what year it was and different interior tones and all that stuff.
Yeah, and you've probably seen these on the road, especially if you're in the States. They've got checkered flagging on the fenders and doors. Mm-hmm. They've got the TAZ decals. They've got a race-inspired, do you feel my finger quotes when I'm saying this, race-inspired rear spoiler.
Yeah, it's supposed to look like the NASCAR rear spoiler. And
supposed to, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. A limited edition plaques on the trunk and, you know, the Monte Carlo script on the dash, which is replaced with the words pace car. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of limited edition type stuff. And, you know, of course, they had these, a decent-sized V6 engine, a 3800 V6 engine. Mm-hmm. All of them had ground effects, you know, these what they call Galaxy Silver ground effects.
Yeah.
Stainless steel dual exhaust tips and 16-inch wheels and, you know, just unusual things that made them, you know, part of the pace car group that Chevrolet released. And they all had a similar look, similar feel, but different treatment, I guess, maybe. Mm-hmm. And they all had different kind of, I don't know if you want to say sponsorship, but I mean, some were meant to look like Dale Jr.'s car, and some were made to look like, you know, the, Jeff Gordon's car.
Yeah.
So they had different color schemes that went along with this, and they all matched kind of the NASCAR push for that year.
Right, yeah, and the NASCAR feel. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, around the same time, concurrently, there was one, I guess let's call it one last cry from Monte Carlo in 06, where they thought, what if we put the V8 in there?
So in 2006, I mean, I thought that was a good choice. I mean, they did this whole thing with, like, you know, a V8 engine, but I think a lot of people also kind of raised their eyebrows and said, what are you doing building a V8 powered front wheel drive car?
Right. Yeah. If you're going to have a V8, it's probably going to be better for the rear wheel. It was a little bit like a dollar short day late situation.
Yeah, I guess. But I mean, it's a strong engine. It was a 5.3 liter LS4 V8. And, you know, of course,
in the SS model.
In the SS model. And of course, they're only doing, you know, automatic transmissions at the time. So that's another thing that people are saying, like, well, you're not even going to give me the option of a manual in this.
Right.
I just don't, a lot of people, there was a lot of disconnect, I guess, in that decision. But I think it was kind of one of the last breaths of the Monte Carlo. And they said, well, let's just throw another SS model out there and see how it sells.
Right. And, so despite these two moves, despite the pace car marketing and despite the SS option to bring the V8 back, you know, I wonder if they had had rear wheel drive, if that would have been enough.
But you know what, Ben? This is exactly where this comes in, and you got to remember the car that replaced it. And this is really important because it's another two-door coupe that replaced it, and it's a good replacement, I think. They brought back, and I say replacement, and I've troubled myself with this over the way to say this, because I'm saying replacement. They brought the Camaro back as a replacement for the Monte Carlo.
Mm-hmm.
What it did was it filled the coupe position for Chevrolet. It's not necessarily that, you know, it replaced it, because those two cars existed at the same time. So it's not like Camaro's brand new, of course. But Camaro did come back.
Mm-hmm.
So they've replaced the coupe position with the Camaro, and that's been very successful for them so far, and we see those everywhere. But it's exactly the position that Monte Carlo filled prior to that.
Right, and the last Monte Carlo rolled off the line on a Tuesday in June of 2007. You can still see, or I don't know if you can see it, maybe if you're maybe if you're good with words and you can get in good with the GM folks, but it's at their Heritage Center, the last Monte Carlo off the production line.
Yeah.
And, the second last was auctioned off, at Mannheim's, auto auction in North Carolina. And the guy who won it is a guy named Fred Simon, who owns Simon Chevrolet. Shout out to Fred if you're listening. I guess we both like those cars. Not going to say I'm jealous. I have a copy myself.
I would be jealous, Ben, because that one was signed by everybody, I believe, at the Brickyard 400.
Ah, that's true.
On that final weekend. Mm-hmm. So that one's got kind of a lot of nostalgia to it, I suppose. And to own the last saleable car from a product line, that's a big deal. That's why they auction off stuff like that. I mean, that's why it ends up bringing a lot of money for charities. Now, the last thing, Ben, that I want to cover here, and I think, have you got any more on Monte Carlo that you want to say? I mean, maybe just maybe a final word from you after this, but... any more like stats or figures or anything you want to throw in there? Or are we good to move on to NASCAR here?
You know, I think that we would be remiss if we didn't go right to NASCAR.
All right. So NASCAR, we've talked about it all along the way and we've hinted that, you know, it was a big deal. Now, this goes all the way back to the very beginning. So back all the time when we were talking about the Gen 1 stuff, the Gen 2 stuff,
yeah.
You know, way back in the 1970s, early 70s.
From 72 on.
It was a solid success in NASCAR. I mean, Monte Carlo was among the winningest race cars in the entire series for the whole time of NASCAR, really. I mean, it's really, really prevalent. I mean, if you look through the results from the 1970s, 1980s, you're going to see a lot of Monte Carlos in the top spot.
It dominates.
You know what? That's a good way to say it. It dominates because it eventually brought repeated NASCAR Manufacturers Cup awards, mm-hmm. You know, all the way until its discontinuation through 2007, really, for Chevrolet. So, you know, it was a very, very successful car. They had the big, you know, the big body cars from the 1973 to about 1977.
Yep.
In 1980, NASCAR moved to a smaller wheelbase car, which was, you know, any of the cars built by Detroit were a little smaller in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
So they moved to this like 110-inch wheelbase, and they responded to that. And that's when they came out with that flat-nose Monte Carlo car from the 1981-82. But the flat nose cars were not really doing all that well in the series. They weren't
right.
They weren't quite up to snuff like the other cars. So what they did was they revamped the front end, and with the SS that I mentioned in 1983,
mm-hmm.
you know, when they redesigned that, they brought the SS nose to NASCAR as well, and it became dominant in the series.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a matter of changing that front nose on the car, on the production car, that allowed them to do it in NASCAR. That allowed them to come back into victory circle. So
and through the rest of that decade, right? Through the rest of the 80s.
Through the rest of the 80s, all the way until, you know, it discontinued in 88.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1995, they actually made a comeback again. And there was like this whole rear fender controversy, you know, between allowing them to use different metal than the sheet metal they used on the production
right.
car.
Was NASCAR bending the rules
exactly.
for the racing legend?
And I think they were in a little bit. And, but you know, of course, to get Monte Carlo back on the track, I think they were all excited about doing that. So they bent them a little bit. And then eventually things worked their way out. And then finally, you know, from 95 until about 2007, it was in 2007, I should say, it was replaced by the Impala. And that's what Chevrolet has been fronting ever since. So, and are they on Camaro now? I don't even know at this point what they're doing. Impala may be the car, but anyways, it's definitely not the Monte Carlo that's been around since, or that ended around 2007.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, you can't say enough about Monte Carlo and NASCAR. I mean, the two are hand in hand. They're forever tied together.
Right. And, let's also mention Dale Earnhardt's, Wrangler sponsored famous yellow and blue number 3.
I remember that car.
Yeah, the Aero Deck prepared, customized by a guy, Richard Childress. This, went into Daytona 500. He won the Busch Clash with it. He won one of two 125 mile qualifying races. He took this car everywhere and anywhere.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, who can forget, you know, the Intimidator and his tie in with Monte Carlo? It all plays out. I mean, this Monte Carlo, I'll tell you, but when we first dug into this, I really didn't think I was going to find a whole lot of interest here. I thought we were going to mostly be talking about your car, your specific car, and what you kind the idiosyncrasies that are involved with that, you know, and the strangeness of it, you know, like what, you know, how do you keep it running and some of the odd tricks that you need to keep it moving, right? I thought that's kind of like what this podcast is mostly going to be about, but I didn't realize that Monte Carlo was so rich in history.
Yeah, and thank goodness, because we should never put out a podcast with me just complaining about my car, man.
Well,
people can do that on their own.
I knew there was going to be more than that. I knew there was going to be some, you know, little interesting stories. And we didn't even talk about movie cars or anything like that. But there's some Monte Carlo movie cars that we should mention. You know, Fast and Furious. They've got some amazing car that is kind of the thing of the stuff of legend, I guess, in this one particular model. But man, there's just so much involved with Monte Carlo that I had no idea. I mean, I've missed all of that history. I knew that I liked the second gens that my cousins owned.
Yeah, you knew about NASCAR already.
I knew about the one that you had. I didn't know that you had two, which was kind of an interesting fact that you brought up. But
yeah, I'm sketchy.
so that's good. I was happy to hear about that. But man, there's even more to it than that. And you know, the stuff that we read, it seems like we just get to cover the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, and we fall into that often, you know, because you know how it is, Scott. If we didn't have to keep our shows to a reasonable, listenable amount of time, then we would probably still be doing our, you know, one of our like Henry Ford episodes or something.
Probably. We'd still be talking about Terry Henlein and how he was working with the 69 Pontiac Grand Prix and how he's adapting that. And I mean,
is a hell of a story.
Yeah, there is. There's just so much involved with this and all the people that are involved in it and have touched the Monte Carlo in some way. You know, they have some kind of influence on this thing. I mean, going back to John DeLorean and Pete Estes and
Dave Halls.
Yeah, yeah, Knudsen and all those guys. I mean, the interesting characters involved in this all the way through Bill Mitchell and everybody. Mm-hmm.
And we hope that you have enjoyed our two-part look at the rise and fall of the Monte Carlo. We also hope that you will drop us a line on Facebook or Twitter at CarStuffHSW. And who knows, we might even feature your comments on the air. But let us know what you'd like us to cover in an upcoming episode. You can send us an email directly. Our address is
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.